Good afternoon. It's 3:45 Wednesday, September 4th. This is the TDN Writers Room Podcast. I'm Joe Bianca, Associate Editor at the Thoroughbred Daily News.
My name is Bill Finley, and I guarantee you I'm the only person who's ever worked for the Thoroughbred Daily News who has attended the races in Fargo, North Dakota.
Brian DiNato, Racing Editor at the TDN.
Jonathan Green, General Manager of DJ Stable, and also a part of the Green Group, which is an accounting firm and tax consulting firm.
So we already have something different from last week. We have a guest. It's John Green of DJ Stable, owner of A Thread of Blue, who's running in the Jockey Club Derby this Saturday. John, welcome to the TDN Writers Room Podcast.
Thank you so much. It's very exciting to be here.
So I guess we'll start with a basic kind of overview of how you and your family got into thoroughbred racing.
Basically, it occurred about 30 years ago, if you can believe it, where we were had an opportunity to go to Monmouth Park with one of our neighbors. Sure enough, the neighbor owned a $5,000 claimer. The horse won. I got to win a $5 win ticket on him. I was 8 years old, so $20 in my pocket was a huge deal. Plus, I got a free hot dog, so you couldn't beat that day. And we got to go to the winner's circle. And the end result was we were driving home, and my dad said, "Did you have a good time?" And I said, "Yeah, it was great. You know, what could be better than this?" He said, "Yeah, and if our neighbor could win a race, imagine what we could do." And like I said, that was 30 years ago and 2,100 wins ago and 8,000 losses ago. But we've always enjoyed, racing and competing here on the Jersey Shore.
And you have children, right?
I do. I have two daughters, one of which is actually very involved in the breeding game. She's been to Keeneland with me. She's been to the Saratoga sale and really enjoys that aspect. And the other one is not so involved in racing, but she loves naming the horses. And we just actually named a horse after her alma mater, Colby, after Colby College. And Colby will be running in a stake race at Monmouth Park in a couple of weeks.
It's Maine, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep, exactly. Incidentally, we named another horse Maine as
I can't
well.
That wasn't taken.
I know. It's really, I think it was the only state in the union that wasn't accepted yet. So.
All right. So we'll get to the horse. We'll get to the big horse first, the Thread of Blue. I feel like there was a little bit of a question about him going a mile and three sixteenths, and he proved the doubters wrong. Now he's going a mile and a half. What was the decision-making process in terms of whether or not to tackle that?
You know, that's a great question. We go back and forth whenever we talk about a specific horse, especially at this level, because there are so many opportunities to run in big ticket races, especially this time of year. The opportunity to run him up at Saratoga in the Saratoga Derby was daunting. As you mentioned, he hadn't really won going more than a mile and 16th, so to add on an extra furlong is a little daunting, especially for a front-running horse. Kieran McLaughlin really did a phenomenal job getting air into the horse, training the horse, and between his training and Louis Size's, expertise on the front end, that's really what enabled the horse to go to the front and never look back.
And John, now if you look back at the situation, the purchase of the horse at Ocala for $430,000, even at that money, that's turned out to be a very good buy, would be a grade one winner, except that last race was in its inaugural running, so it was not a grade one. But usually at that sale, people are not looking for mile and a half grass horses. Right. And this horse doesn't really have that much of a grass pedigree. I can't imagine you, your father, your family were thinking, we're going to spend $430,000 on this horse, someday win a mile and 3/16 grass race at Saratoga. He must have turned out to be, yes, good, like you thought he would be, but not exactly the kind of horse you thought.
Not exactly. Your point is well taken, Bill. I think anytime you buy a horse, regardless of the amount, you're going to have a preconceived notion of where you think the horse is going to run. As we know, they're athletes and they're temperamental, and sometimes your best guess is not what they're willing to do. The very first race, we actually tried him on the dirt because we anticipated him being able to handle, the dirt race. And I think he beat one horse in the ambulance, and that was it. So then at that point, we decided to try him on the turf because he does have a lot of European blood. The mare enthused actually has produced 4 graded stake winners in Europe. And because of that, we thought, okay, the turf may be ultimately what he wants to do. And kind of the rest is history. But you're right. Anytime you spend that kind of money on a horse, you're hoping that he's going to go 2 turns on the dirt because that's where the big money is. But I think that's starting to change here. The climate and the interest of turf racing here in the United States is starting to improve.
In terms of stretching him out, has anything in his training or anything in his demeanor changed as he's gotten older and as he's matured?
That's another good question. I think Blue, personality-wise, has changed a little bit. Once he won the 3 races in a row, you could see his confidence build, And he started walking around the barn almost like King Kong. I mean, he really was ready to take on all comers at that point. And horses are like that. They get that kind of enjoyment and excitement about being the alpha. And that goes from thousands and thousands of years of genetic breeding. But he feels like he's the alpha now. And that's why we were so surprised when we sent him over to Penn National running the Penn Mile. And he didn't run as well. It took him almost 2 full weeks before he got his mojo back. Hmm.
So now looking ahead to Saturday's race, what do you make of the field and how do you like your chances?
You know, when we sat down with Kieran about 2 weeks ago to decide if we were going to run the horse in the third leg of this Turf Trinity, there was the question of, can he go this far? Can he go a mile and a half? And you really don't have a lot of basis to make that estimate. Normally, you would think, okay, comfort behind horses would lend themselves to be able to go that distance. But an old trainer friend of mine, Joe Orsino, told me years ago, if you have a front-running horse and you can relax him on the lead, then the race really doesn't start until the top of the stretch. And I think that's really what happened with the Saratoga Derby, and we're hoping that's going to happen with the with this Derby as well.
And John, I couldn't agree more with Joe Orsino. I think the New York has the best riding colony in the country. But one thing that they do is when you get in these marathon turf races, they all lose their minds. I mean, everybody wants to go 53-4, 117.
Right. Yep.
And it looks in this race, even though the last time out, your fractions were not that slow at all, you're the only speed in the race. You draw the rail. You have a smart jockey in Luis Saez. Even if you're not necessarily the prototypical mile and a half horse, can't you see yourself getting that kind of trip? And if so, I would think it'd be pretty hard to run down.
No question about it. We're hoping that the first, you know, 4 furlongs, 6 furlongs, they time in a sundial. We're hoping that he goes really, really slow on the front end. And if you go, you know, horse by horse in this race, there are some great accomplished horses, especially as 3-year-olds. Current is certainly a legitimate horse. Digital Age, who we've run against a few times, is a legitimate horse. And even some of the European horses coming in have made their bones in their respective racetracks. I think that every horse in the field, including us, you can make a case for, and you can also question whether or not they're going to handle this. There's a couple of horses that you'd say they ran lifetime bests, us included. Are we going to bounce? The European horses are coming in. They like to sit from way off it, and they run clockwise versus, we're used to running counterclockwise. I can't see how, you know, that's good for them coming here and trying to run the race in the complete opposite direction. It's kind of like if we tried to drive there, you know, there's got to be a little bit of a learning curve there. And then there's also a couple of horses in here that we've run against before, and quite frankly, we've earned the dream trip and they haven't. And one of these days, the tables are turned. So I'm really looking forward to being in the race. And don't get me wrong, I wouldn't trade our position with anybody, but I think that there you can make a case for 4 or 5 horses in the race.
John, you mentioned early on that everybody who goes to the sales, usually the first thing they think of is, we want a classic mile and eighth, mile and quarter dirt horse. You can take a look at Thread of Blue and you can probably make a case for one or two things. One, he just doesn't like the dirt. Or two, maybe when you did run him on the dirt, he hadn't developed into the horse that he is now. Now, if scenario two is correct, maybe perhaps this is someday a Whitney-type horse, and where the money, even though these horses are so big for these turf races, but nonetheless, the money is normally bigger. If you're ever talking about developing a sire, you're going to be so much better off if you win a grade one. This is a long-winded way of asking, have you guys and Kieran McLaughlin thought, you know, if not this year, maybe next year, someday we'll give them another try in the dirt?
I would think so. I think what's going to happen eventually is we're going to run in some big race, some big turf race, and it's going to come off the turf. And at that point in time, we say, okay, we've shipped to Kalamazoo. We're here. They're still putting up the same amount of money.
I love that track, by the way.
I know. You mentioned that before.
I had a superfecta there one time.
I wouldn't doubt that.
Yes.
So there'll be an opportunity where we're going to, you know, the race will scratch down to a certain small number of horses. None of them are accomplished on the dirt. And at that point, we'll try it. I don't know if we're going to go out of our way to try him on the dirt unless he really shows that there's an opportunity there for us. And just to give you an example, you know, when we are picking out races, we're not only picking out races for this specific horse, but we currently have a number of horses in training, and we almost take the mutual fund approach, where we look at it and say, it doesn't matter if a Thread of Blue wins, or Jaywalk, or Proven Strategies, we're not really as concerned about which one wins, as long as somebody in the group wins and carries the rest of the crew. If we are fortunate enough, like a Thread of Blue won the $1 million race a few weeks ago, we could then take one of our other horses, in this case, Diamond King, and try him, who's an accomplished dirt horse, and try him on the turf, because we had almost a get out of jail free card. We had enough money where, you know, it was going to pay for everybody and we could test and try somebody else out. The Diamond King turf experiment didn't work last week, but that's not to say that we wouldn't try it with blue, you know, down the road.
Just wanted to broaden this out real quick and talk about the Turf Trinity, inaugural Turf Trinity. I talked to Jeff Bloom. What do you think about the Turf Trinity? He's like, I love it. So I'm sure you're going to have a similar response. But do you see it as something that has staying power in New York?
I would really like to think so. I think that with the political situation right now, where everyone is looking at the industry and trying to figure out what is the root cause of, you know, horses breaking down, whether it's recently in California or as early back as the first, you know, few Breeders' Cups, where it seemed like every single Breeders' Cup day, there was a horse breaking down. And I think as an industry, we all want to get to the root of the problem, whether it's the track itself or medication, you know, the horses being inbred, whatever it is, we want to figure out what the issue is. One of the solutions, though, that I personally feel is out there is running horses on the turf. It's softer, it's better for their bones, and if they're training on the turf, it seems to lay bone down, you know, kind of like the way that Calumet does it and the way that Darby Dan used to do it, where they would constantly try their horses or train their horses on the grass until they got to be a three-year-old, and then they would try them on the dirt.
John, let's talk about Jaywalk. It is a bit probably safe to say that she has not been as good this year as you would have hoped. She had that great comeback race at Delaware Park, and then everybody was, oh boy, the old Jaywalk is back. Then she got beat, by, albeit by a good horse in Horologist, but then finished second in the Monmouth Oaks. What is her status? Is she on the trail of the Cotillion? And has the team figured out any reasons why maybe she has not necessarily looked like the Jaywalk of last year?
Yeah, and you know, we've gone back and forth with John Service, who trains her, to try to figure out, you know, why Jaywalk hasn't gotten to the next level. And, you know, part of the problem is that a lot of other horses have caught up to her. When they win big races as a two-year-old, whether it's the Breeders' Cup as a two-year-old or the hopeful you guys were talking about last week, and why don't horses continue to develop? Well, it may be that they develop to that extent, you know, early on. We really feel like for Jaywalk that even though it looks like on paper she hasn't gotten to the next level, she's still running consistent numbers that are good enough to win some of these grade twos and grade ones against other fillies. I put it on myself as the general manager that maybe we put her in a couple of races that we shouldn't have because they were tougher than we anticipated. But ultimately, she is on path to run into the Cotillion. And then after the Cotillion, it is a win and you're in. If she wins, we will send her to California. If not, then we have to kind of reassess what we're going to do with her.
Worst case scenario, you still got that Eclipse statue on your shelf.
So I understand they never take that. It away from you, which is always a nice thing. It's actually sitting, you know, I have one of them that's sitting in my home office, and I know my dad has one in his home in his business office as well. And I think there's actually a spotlight on his, understand.
Pretty exclusive club.
It really is. And we felt very fortunate to be there and also to be there with our partner, you know, from Cassius King. Chuck Zachney has been just a phenomenal partner with us on Diamond King and on Jaywalk and a couple of these babies. It's amazing, just to digress for a second, a lot of these partnerships seem to be fine until a horse gets really good. And then once a horse gets good, then everyone has an opinion about what to do, and that's where the problem is. If you have a partner on a $10,000 claimer, nobody really cares. Mm-hmm. Okay, the horse is going to run for 10 either at Monmouth or Delaware, and you punt.
Yeah.
But he's been a phenomenal partner and a great friend to enjoy the ride with.
Speaking of Jaywalk, you found her in book four of Keeneland September, if I'm not mistaken. I assume you're planning to go back there this weekend?
Absolutely. We'll certainly attend Keeneland. It's been historically a great sale for us as far as rate of return and as far as stakes winners and stakes performers. As you mentioned, we found Jaywalk in book four. My understanding is that there were just as many grade one winners out of book four and five combined as there were in book one, two, and three combined over the past 3 years. So you can find good horses anywhere.
How do you typically prepare for such a large sale?
You know, we will go through all 4,600 pedigrees and immediately knock off any of the ones that either we haven't been lucky with in the past or we just don't feel like fits our program. And also from a price standpoint, there's a lot of horses that are going to sell for $500,000 or more that's out of our price range, and a few horses that don't make sense because they may be locally bred, an Ohio bred or a Kalamazoo bred, that will that aren't of as much interest.
Don't be knocking Kalamazoo. I'm telling you, it's a really nice racetrack.
The funny thing about it is we actually, 20 years ago, we actually had the Michigan bred horse of the year, a horse named my papa. So I am very familiar with, I didn't catch any bets on him, but I'm very familiar with the Michigan program. So I don't mean to denigrate that.
And I'm sure he won the Kalamazoo Derby, which landed that trophy right next to your Eclipse Award for Jaywalk on your mantle at home.
We'll go with that, right?
What's the Michigan Bread Awards night like?
Michigan, it's at a Denny's, and it's usually bring your own, so...
Okay, so I guess we're gonna segue here to the past weekend's racing, a lot of big races. And John, if you want to stick around and chime in, we're happy to have you. So I guess we'll start with the hopeful. We did a little thing on the hopeful last week, as you mentioned, John. Steve Asmussen had a really good hand heading into it and couldn't have worked out better. Ran 1-2-3. Basin is the one that was the longest price of the three, and he ended up dominating both of his stable mates and the rest of the field. Looked like Shoplifted, ran on late, started to find his feet pretty much in the second half of the race. What stood out to you guys, and feel free anybody here, about the hopeful and the performance of Basin?
Well, what stood out was the performance of the trainer. I mean, when's the last time we talked about somebody finishing 1-2-3 in a grade one stakes race and it wasn't Chad Brown?
Chad Brown, right.
You know, Steve Asmussen deserves a tremendous amount of credit. Now, granted, these were the first three favorites in the race. Granted, Greenlight Go, who likely would have been the favorite, was scratched. But, you know, to win the first grade one of the year on the East Coast and not only win it and finish 1-2-3 is a tremendous accomplishment. And we had talked last time on the podcast about the fact that basically if you win the hopeful, you can pretty much forget about winning the Kentucky Derby because it hasn't happened since 1978. But I got a sneaking suspicion that maybe things will change this year for a couple of reasons. First of all, these are three very good horses. And second of all, doesn't it feel to you guys that these great trainers like Steve Asmussen, they wait their turn, they wait their turn, they wait their turn, and eventually they get it. It comes to him. Steve Asmussen is not a particularly old guy. He's going to win a Kentucky Derby before his career is over. Maybe it's in 2020. Of the three, I like Basin the best. Why wouldn't you? He won and looked pretty good. By Liam's map, no reason to think with that sire. He couldn't go a mile and a quarter. So maybe the hopeful Kentucky Derby jinx will be broken next year.
All you had to do was bring it up on the podcast.
That's right. There you go. Right.
Time's ticking for it now.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, Bill, I agree with your sentiment about, you know, what a phenomenal training job this was, you know, coming into the hopeful. I think you're right also, though, that Greenlight Go really was the horse to beat in that race. You know, we ran against him actually with Another Miracle, and he, you know, Another Miracle is a 5-furlong turf horse who won the Skidmore and is going to hopefully run in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Turf, and he ran us off our feet. And when was the last time you saw a hard spun out of a pleasantly perfect mare win and win impressively?
Trained by Jimmy Jerkins,
exactly. It doesn't crank his horses up until later. And again, to go back to the medication, is still not on Lasix. So there's a lot of upside, I think, on Greenlight Go. He's beaten some phenomenal horses already early on in the business. The main story is, look what a great job Steve did with his first three finishers. But very close second has got to be, keep an eye on Greenlight Go. And I'm not telling anybody anything that they don't know already, but that horse really impressed me just as an outsider looking in.
And speaking of turf sprinters, I'd love to see Gozilla in a turf sprint. I think he has turf sprint written all over him. The Dam was a turf miler. She's a half to, I think, two graded stakes winners on the grass. And he's just one of those horses who seems a little too quick maybe to want to stretch out. And he looked really good at OBS April on the synthetic, so I think he's probably a turf sprinter.
I think you're right. I think if you look at his genetics, it says turf sprint all over it. Gary Barber, incidentally, bought 25% of him before this race. And the rumor is that he bought it for $1 million. So the horse was basically a $4 million valuation. I'm not sure they're going to go immediately to a 5-furlong sprint based on that valuation. I think he did it based on, hey, I want this horse to run in the classics, or at least, you know, some of the opportunities that avail themselves over the next couple of weeks. But you're right. If you look genetically, that horse absolutely screams sprint turf.
Well, let's switch coasts now and go take a look at what happened with the two-year-olds out at Del Mar. And first, I want to give Jim McInvale. This, of course, was the Run Happy Del Mar Futurity. And I have a radio show I do with Dave Johnson on Sirius XM Radio every Saturday from 10 a.m. to 1 Eastern on Channel 156. And we had Mac on last week. He says, Mac, what's left to sponsor? You sponsored everything but the third race at Timonium today. He says, next year I'm sponsoring the toilet paper in the bathroom at Del Mar. You know what? I wouldn't put it
past him. You think he's kidding?
No, I wouldn't put it past them to do that. But, you know, we had talked again about last week on the podcast that this race, normally we learn more about the Kentucky Derby contenders. And by and large, that's simply because Bob Baffert, he won the thing 14 times. And with horses like American Pharoah, and you can note that a Bob Baffert horse, if it's got talent as a two-year-old, has a darn good chance of becoming running in the Kentucky Derby. This race proved absolutely nothing. It was an absolute mess. I mean, Eight Rings, the Baffert horse, was 1-2 fell. And then a horse that just came out of a claiming race, albeit a $100,000 claiming race, trained by the Peter Miller by the name of Nucky. I assume those of you who watch Boardwalk Empire would realize it's probably named after Nucky Thompson, mm-hmm. the character on there. Great show, by the way. Wins the race, pays a zillion dollars. Peter Miller's won too. Did anybody think that that race shed any light on this year's two-year-old crop and how they may advance towards next year's Kentucky Derby?
I mean, I was talking to Brian before. It was a strange race to watch visually. Obviously, the race was turned upside down a couple strides out of the gate when eight Rings took a left turn. Reminded me a lot of Dreyfong a couple years ago. Right. Did the same thing. I think he was the number two as well, big favorite. It was a fast pace, and Nucky made a pretty early move. A 3/8 pole, went to the lead. They went 21 and change, 44 and change, and it seemed like they were really gasping for air late, but nobody closed. So I think that's part of the reason that you can't take too much from it, is just it didn't seem like, other than the winner, anybody really picked up their feet. And it's the buyer says that. The buyer is 68, I believe, which is probably the lowest.
Wow, yeah, it's got to be among the lowest grade one winning buyers.
That may not win a maiden 35 sometimes.
Yeah, so that's I think about old horses who run grade ones with slow figures. Sutra, when she won the Frisette, I believe. Yeah. She was like a 69 buyer or something along those lines. But yeah, so visually it kind of told the tale that they were coming home slow, but nobody closed. So I would kind of draw a line through that race for everybody except maybe the winner. But how do you guys feel?
Well, first of all, I swear this is the last time I'll do that. That buyer number would not win the feature at Kalamazoo, would it, John?
No question about it. And, you know, you mentioned it wouldn't win a maiden race. There were two maidens in this race. Yeah. So, again, it may just be, what did he beat? I think you're right. You can put a line through the majority of horses, if not all of them, including the winner, and basically say, you know, he's going to have to prove it to me again.
Yeah.
I thought what Eight Rings did was actually pretty amazing. He was way, way out of it. You would have assumed he kind of just would have been pulled up or would have pulled himself up. And he managed to pass almost everybody in the stretch and galloped out well. I mean, he seemed like a superior horse going in. He probably is, obviously.
It kind of looked like, remember that race with Long Weekend and Dennis's Moment, the Roman's horse? And and Long Weekend opened up by 10 lengths. Right. Dennis's Moment lost the jockey and then ended up with him right on the wire. And then so what Dennis's Moment did next time out. So. Exactly. One thing I wanted to touch on before we moved on from last week's races was the Woodward, and I thought it was a pretty gutsy effort by Preservationist and a kind of an interesting horse who took a long time to put things together. I think he might have run like 5 or 6 times in 3 seasons, and now he's put 3 races together. He was dominant in the Suburban, didn't run that great in the Whitney, but really bowled through traffic in the stretch to take the Woodward, and it kind of made me think about the older male dirt division. And last year at this point, we had Accelerate, who was well on his way to a championship. There really was nothing that anybody could do to be a fly in the ointment there. But this year, I mean, you look at the big races. The Big Cap was won by Giftbox, the Gold Cup, Vino Rosso, the Foster, Seeking the Soul. Preservationist now has 2 grade one wins. McKinsey won the Whitney and the Ali Sheba. Higher Power wins the Pacific Classic. To me, the clear leader in this division is a horse that might win another championship, and that's Matoli. He's got 3 grade one wins now on the year. Nobody else, as far as I know, in the older dirt male division has 2. Does anybody have a problem with Matoli winning both of those awards?
Yeah, I got a big problem with that. He's a sprinter. And I'm old school. I believe that the sprinters have their own category. Leave it to that. Yeah, I mean, you can't, it's not fair, because if you give him the Eclipse Award for both sprint and root horse, well, McKinsey, he's not eligible for the sprint award. And I also think that as well as Preservationist ran, and you're right, what a gutsy effort. I mean, horse showed a tremendous amount of tenacity. Big winner in that race was McKinsey. I mean, so Preservationist wins the Suburban, gets his doors blown off by McKinsey in the Whitney, and then comes back and wins the Woodward. I think that right now, you know, everybody's staying the way they are. With all due respect to Matoli, because I don't include him in this group, I include him in the sprint group, or maybe perhaps they go in the dirt mile. I don't know what their plans are, but I would think the sprint would be more likely. I just think it's McKenzie and everybody else. You know, he's going to go in the awesome again. He should win that. And unless he lays an egg Breeders' Cup day, which I don't see, it's going to be hard to surpass that horse.
I think it would have been a stronger argument for McKenzie if he hadn't lost to Mattoli. Now, I understand he had trouble in the Met Mile, but they faced head-to-head, and Mattoli beat him. So I think at the end of the year, that's going to hold a little bit of weight. I wanted to talk about freshman sires, there was a ton of hype going into this year's class. Obviously, the headliner was American Pharoah, but there were a lot of horses that people were excited to see their foals, Honor Code and Liam's Map and such. I think some of them might have gotten off to a little bit of a slow start. Liam's Map didn't have that many winners, but then he had a pretty seismic winner with Basin. Do you guys think that this class has lived up to the hype so far, and what do you think about them going forward?
Well, my first question would be, and I'm the last guy that should be answering that question because that's not my field of expertise. I want to hear what the other three, but isn't it a little bit too early to tell? Can we really judge them on September 2nd? And the only thing I would add to that is that, at least from the numbers, American Pharoah certainly seems to be living up to expectations, leading at least wins-wise. From the TDN website, I learned that he has 12 winners right now, which puts him in the number one. When I was interviewing people before the year, everybody thought that the Pharoahs would not be early developers, that they would be more fall, you know, champagne, Breeders' Cup, juvenile type horses, not, you know, win first out at Saratoga the first week of the meet, or win at Del Mar the first week of the meet. So that would be my one comment. But again, I would like to pass the microphone to people that know a lot more about this than I do.
Yeah, and just going through the sales, as often as we do, you tend to gravitate towards certain freshman sires based on the foals that you see. And, sometimes it's real hit or miss. But I know going through this crop of two-year-olds, Liam's Map was the one that continually was ringing the bell at sales. And it almost didn't matter what sale it was. If there was a Liam's Map, people were immediately jumping on top of it and trying to buy it. You know, I concur, Bill, with your comment about American Pharoah. It's not just because we own one. We own one that's running well. But who would have thought that he would have thrown two-year-old runners and early two-year-old runners, precocious runners, and mostly on the turf. You know, so again, you go back to the argument of can we anticipate based on genetics and based on crosses, and you almost have to just try them out. But American Pharoah has certainly hit the ground running. Liam's Map looks like he's going to start to develop some good horses. Constitution and Honor Code were the other two of the top four horses that, at least from a yearling's sales price standpoint, rounded out the group. And I think all four of them are going to represent. It's just a question of, hey, it's only Labor Day. Let's wait and see, you know, how things play out in the next 3 or 4 months before we send in the verdict.
Constitution is an interesting one because, like you say, there was a little bit of buzz about him, but stands for 15,000, or at least did in his first season. Tied for the top, I believe, right now in overall winners. He's got 12. He's got 3 stakes winners, I believe. He's got 3 TDN Rising Stars, the most important metric of all.
Now talk about shameless plugs there, right, by the way.
Yeah. So, yeah, his horses have been really, I think, jumping out a lot, especially at Saratoga. And it's going to be interesting to see if he keeps that up because he was, I guess, was a little bit of a late-developing 3-year-old. And, you know, he did his best work in the summer. But yeah, he's really stood out to me.
And no question about it. And also, Constitution, out of the top 4, he has the least number of prospects that are out there, of overall foals, I should say, that are out there even. Honor Code by far had the most, American Pharoah, Liam's Map, and then Constitution in that order. So you would think that just based on crop size, that some of these other horses would kind of rise to the top. That's why it's been amazing to watch Constitution do what he's done.
Mm-hmm. Another one I wanted to shout out who hasn't gotten that much buzz is Tapiture. Tapiture horses have been pretty good first out. I think he's got 11 or 12 winners. So he's one that, in the same vein as Cross Traffic, who might not have had so much hype going in, that by the end of his first racing year, everybody knew about him.
Everyone knew about him, and now he might be headed to Turkey. So if that's not the rubber stamp of what the next great sire is going to be, it's, you know, send him on a boat to Turkey or Korea, and all of a sudden they start having huge runners again.
Well, it's up to you to carry the flag with Jatewalk. So.
I think another one to keep an eye on going forward might be Wicked Strong. He did pretty well at the 2-year-old sales, and he wasn't a particularly early developing horse. I think he maybe debuted maybe September of his 2-year-old year and was more of a 3-year-old. So I would expect to see some Wicked Strongs running well in the coming weeks.
Yeah, other one I wanted to bring up was Tonalist. Mm-hmm. Tonalist might have gotten off to a little bit of a slow start, but all those horses, most of those horses are running in five and a half, six right. furlong races. You would expect him with his long-winded racing record, and obviously most famous for winning the Belmont. I think you would expect him, as the horses get to go two turns, they'll pick it up. Mm-hmm. Bill, you did a story with Dave O'Rourke of the New York Racing Association, $700 million plus handle this year for Naira at Saratoga with the new schedule. What were your impressions from what Dave told you?
Well, it's not my impressions. Mainly came from the numbers that were put out at the end. I remember before the meet, I asked David O'Rourke, what do you expect is going to happen with the new format, the 8 weeks, 5 days? He goes, I'm not going to answer that question until closing day. So on closing day, I called him and said, David, what did you think? And of course, the numbers speak for themselves. They hit it out of the park at this meet. Now, you take those numbers, they set an all-time record handle number. They were up, I believe, 7% over last year on all sources handle. And way back when, which now seems like 7 years ago on Haskell Day, when it was so hot they had to cancel, that cost them, I asked them, in about $21 million in handle as well. So the 8-week, 5-day format worked magnificently, and there's no doubt that it's here to stay. The one thing O'Rourke told me that I thought was kind of interesting, though, was that they're going to put some thought into changing the dark days. Now, instead of having Mondays and Tuesdays dark, he thought there's a chance that they go to Tuesdays and Wednesdays. And he said one of the reasons why is because the Saratoga, the town, you know, the nightlife, the restaurants, the hotels, the bars, etc., he said was completely dead on Sunday nights this year because there was no reason to stick around after the last race on Sunday. Everybody was going home. He said, some of the business owners came to him and said, would you rethink this? He said, yeah, absolutely. We'll take a look at it. And, I asked him, well, why wouldn't you just do what's best for Saratoga, the racetrack? And I really liked the answer he gave me. He says, because this is about much more than just the racetrack. Saratoga works because of the entire community and the entire Saratoga experience. He said, if the restaurants are dead on Sunday night, that's not good for Saratoga, the town. And what's not good for Saratoga, the town, is not good for the New York Racing Association. So I thought that was a really good answer. It was his first time up there running the show after he got promoted. You know, everything went right. You know, that you're always going to have a few problems. It was tragic and kind of bitterly ironic. The very last race of the meet, a horse broke down and had to be put down, which was, geez, you get that far and then it happens in the last race. The weather was reasonably good. I didn't get the final amount of off-the-turf races, but it was fewer than last year. They found a formula. It's here to stay. But another thing, and maybe John, did you spend much time at Saratoga as a fan this year?
Yeah, I was there actually twice.
Okay, I want to get you into this conversation. One thing that was amazing was that the on-track numbers, I didn't get the attendance numbers, but the on-track handle numbers were actually down this year, just by a smidgen. But did you notice anything, or do you have any theories why the on-track handle can be down, yet the all-sources handle, set records?
It really looked like that. Again, this is a layperson's analysis on a very small, sample of days there. Anecdotally, I would say that there were just as many people there who were set up to watch the Breeze shows at 7 in the morning. They were there at 10 o'clock in the morning claiming their picnic tables. And it seemed like that if you had a family reunion or college buddies got together for Saratoga, all those groups continually came in and consistently came in. I think that a lot of people were betting on races. And then for a few days during the meet, there were very small fields. And you guys talked last week about the advantage or one of the benefits of a Kentucky Downs where they have 12, 15 horses in a race, and that's a handicapper's paradise. And I think that for a smidgen, just for a few racing days at Saratoga, where whether it was because of the weather or scratches because of the heat or horses just got sick, but there were, you know, 4, 5, 6 days within a two-week period where most of the average races had 6 or 7 horses in it, if not less. And it's tough to handicap and bet and want to bet on that, on those kind of fields, you know, when they come up that way. That's the only thing I can come up with, though.
I just wanted to ask a follow-up on that. How much do you bet? How much do you handicap? Like, how big of a part is that of your track experience is that?
You know, for me, the bet is when you write the check and you buy the horse, because you're never going to make up that money. That being said, I do enjoy occasionally betting on a horse, especially if I feel like, hey, this is a first-time starter of ours that we feel like is going to do well, or we know that there were a couple of excuses as to why a horse didn't run well, or also we ran in a really tough race, and that's a key race for other horses, and they're going on and running in other races, and we feel like that there's an opportunity there. Interestingly enough, last year there was a letter that came out from Dennis Drazen, who you know is the director at Monmouth Park, prohibiting us as licensed owners from betting of any kind at Monmouth Park. So this summer, we were allowed to go and root for our horses and certainly buy, you know, a hot dog if we wanted to, but we were forbidden from betting, and there would be sanctions of possibly losing your license as an owner if you wanted to bet. So I'm not a good person to ask about Monmouth Park, but when I go to parks or I go to Kentucky Downs or Saratoga, if there's an opportunity, I'll certainly, you know, throw a couple dollars on a horse.
On the Drazen thing, A, do you know what precipitated that? And B, if so, can you tell us?
I'm going to plead the fifth on that.
Okay, that's what I figured.
Can't you send your Aunt Esther to the window to bet for you?
You probably could. You probably could get a surrogate to do it, you know, if you wanted to, or get a runner. But for me, it's just not worth it.
Right.
Yeah.
Not knowing the answer, it sounds like it's such a dumb idea. And Dennis is such a smart guy
yeah.
and such a good racetrack operator. It had to come from the Racing Commission.
Right. Yeah.
And I don't know that for a fact, but I would bet my last dollar that was something completely idiotic that came out of the politicians.
Yeah, Dennis Drazen is going to be the kind of guy that'll tell people not to bet.
Yeah, exactly.
On his own accord.
Yeah. Dennis is way too smart to do something like that. Yeah.
So we talked about the handle increase at Saratoga and the record handle. Not so much for Del Mar. Del Mar had a down meet in terms of handle and attendance, but one thing they did have going for them was no racing fatalities. And I think at this moment, that's kind of an important thing, an important headline to get out there for the sport. And I just being at Saratoga this year, there were a lot of anti-racing protesters when you walked into the gate, and that was something I personally had never seen before. So even though Saratoga and New York has a pretty good safety record, they're kind of focusing on all of racing at this point. And I think it's kind of big for Del Mar to have that kind of flag to put in the ground. And they've been doing this for a while. The safety record has been getting better and better at Del Mar. They've been instating new safety protocols. John, as an owner, how big do you think that this is to have a big boutique meet like this report no racing fatalities?
Oh, no question. It's huge. I mean, just from an outsider on the East Coast, we're keeping tabs on that. You know, we're fortunate enough where we have 4 different horses running in win and you're in races over the next 4 weeks. If there was a concern about safety, they would not be getting on a plane and heading to California, even if they won, because ultimately you want to preserve and protect, you know, your athletes. That being said, the fact that there was a quote-unquote a clean bill of health at Del Mar certainly makes me feel better. I would love to see the additional safety changes that are being implemented at Santa Anita. We're hearing rumors and speculation, but it looks like that for the most part, they're putting their money where their mouth is and they're taking care of that racetrack.
I'm sure Del Mar would have loved to have had better handle numbers, but I'm sure if you asked the people that run that place, if you had 2 choices, you could have 0 fatalities and be down X percent in handle, or be up Y percent in handle and have 7 or 8 horses break down, they would have chose the first part in a heartbeat. This was a huge win, not only for Del Mar, but more so for all of Southern California racing. And I think what it did more so than anything else is it took the heat off of Santa Anita. Because, you know, Del Mar was not the poster child for everything that's wrong with horse racing to the animal rights community. Santa Anita was. And now, if they had a bad meet at Del Mar, then they could have lumped that in with Santa Anita. It would have stirred up all the crap all over again, and then the protesters would have been lined up, you know, 50 deep around Del Mar. It allowed everybody to take a deep breath. And when Santa Anita reopens in a couple weeks, you know, there's been an element now where people tend to forget things over time. And let's just hope that their meet is as safe as Del Mar's was. But I think that Del Mar having the safety factor going for it, there was the accident where two horses collided with one another. And I believe there were four total, but none during racing, which is absolutely huge. I think that was one of the best good news stories we've had in horse racing this year.
I wanted to bring Brian in on this too, because you're a racehorse owner too, and you manage a partnership, I think, with people buying in at a lesser fee. Do you have more casual fans that you kind of try to attract into that? And if so, do they mention this to you? Do they mention the racing fatality kind of rash that we had at Santa Anita?
I've gotten a lot of questions about that, and we have a few owners out in California, and I've talked to them about it, and they were kind of at first interested in maybe me trying to put something together out there, and then they kind of quieted down, and we're happy to focus on other jurisdictions. It's definitely a question I field frequently among our co-owners.
And what do you say? What do you say to people when they ask you about it?
I mean, I'm as straightforward as I can. Obviously, we're all in this for the best interest of the horse, and I think getting that other perspective and seeing how we are with the horses and how we view our horses, I think they kind of see that, you know, it's not maybe what it's made out to be in the media.
I think like a big bit of pushback towards the racing's negative image right now is the counter protesters, is the people that work in racing and the backstretch workers who show up. And I think that's key, is that people who are closest to the horse, if they can show casual fans and laymen that they're about the horse in general, like that's their daily life. They don't do this for the money. It really resonates if you have someone that's on the ground. A bunch of people who are on the ground who can tell you about how much the horse means to them. I think that's big. All right, so that's all we got for you today. I want to thank Brian DiDonato, Bill Finley, and especially John Green, our first guest on the TN Writers Room podcast. Great job. This is Joe Bianca signing off for the TN Writers Room. We'll see you next week.